physical world. So now for the New Testament. I hope that was clear. It's clear as I could. It's on the web if you want to look at it later. Let's read some of it. Romans chapter 8, verse 11. Because the big difference between the New Testament world and the Old Testament world is Jesus. Is the only difference, massive difference. And the experience of Jesus, which we've done earlier. If the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, the life-giving Spirit, he who raised Christ from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies also through his Spirit that dwells in you. So what happened to Jesus will happen to you. That's what Paul's telling them in chapter 8, verse 11, talking about the resurrection. Here we've got 1 Corinthians 15, and these are quoted in the Catechism at different stages there. If Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say there's no resurrection of the dead? Some were saying that because they were Jews probably, and they learnt from the Sadducees that it doesn't exist. So even in the Christian community there was a debate going on. Is there a resurrection of the dead or is there not? Is this life all that we've got, or is there an afterlife? And they weren't sure. So how can some of you be saying this, he says, if there's no resurrection of the dead? Christ hasn't been raised. And if Christ hasn't been raised, our proclamation has been in vain and your faith has been in vain. So it's all just a fairy story. But if Christ is risen, and we know he is, and we experience his presence among us through his Spirit, then think about it. Life's more than this, he's saying to them. And this is the loveliest statement I know in theology still, and it's by Paul. 1 Corinthians 15:42, because the whole of chapter 15 is all about this issue. And Paul says, trying to do his best, and it's a good best, and no one I've found does any better. What is sown, he's talking about, that's the body we've got now, he's already talked about a seed and a tree, and you look at a tree and you wouldn't know it was a seed. If you look at a seed and look at a tree, well, I mean, they don't look like the same thing, but they are. Okay, so what is sown is perishable, this body. What is raised is imperishable. Doesn't tell you much, but that's what he says. What is sown is dishonor. It's not a very positive view of things, but by comparison. But what is raised is glory, and in comparison it's just nothing. The beautiful risen body. Sown in weakness, which we all know, but it's raised in power. And then this wonderful statement he makes, which is never translated properly. It's sown as an ensouled body. The Greek is psychikos, sometimes translated physical body. Very bad translation. Psychikos is from psyche. Psychikos. Ensouled is my best way of putting it, and I can't think of a better one. It's a body that's ensouled. It's given life by your soul. Your thinking and your living and your dreaming and your learning and your language and all the stuff you talk about of mind and will and all that. And that and your body's an expression of it. Unless you get a facelift, in which case you destroy all those beautiful years of learning and loving that you've done. And you kind of look as though you're 16 and you're 60 and everyone can tell anyhow. I'm sorry if you've had a facelift. Maybe I can't tell. But anyhow, like there's no point, for God's sake, let's grow old gracefully with all our history on our face. But, and that's not meant to be advice, it's just a silly thought. It's an ensouled body we've got. What's raised, and this is his exact words, is a spiritual body. Pneumaticos. It's a body that is the expression of the Spirit. And by Spirit, they don't mean soul. They mean your connection with God. It's that community. Spirit is the Spirit of God. So it's your communion with God that actually shows itself in you in your risen state. Here it's your soul, as it were, that's expressed in your body. There it's your spirit. It's an Now, Paul doesn't know what he's saying. I mean, really. I don't know what he's saying, but he's saying something better than what nearly everybody says. You know what I mean? He's struggling with words. How can you? All these words, he knows what he means by all those words. They're all what we experience. Beyond death, we just don't know, but he's faithfully trying to find words that'll get people to realize, because it starts this section with, he says, some of you will wonder what kind of a body we have when we're raised, and he says, this is a stupid question. And then he talks about the stars and all the different bodies. What are you doing talking about thinking you can imagine the risen body? But anyhow, it's imperishable. It's glorious, radiantly beautiful. It's powerful with the power of God's love, and it's communion with God that gives. But it's your whole human person that's... Okay. Oh. Note one, our understanding of the terms body and soul depend on the horizon within which we think of the human condition. The Hebrew world knew no such distinction between body and soul. They didn't have it. Perhaps it's best to state that our whole human reality is taken into life but transformed in a way we cannot imagine. Paul says that beautifully, quoting, no eye has seen, nor ear has heard, nor has the human heart conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. That'll do me. Note two, there are problems too with our understanding of John's use of the expression the last day. On the last day you'll rise again. Chapter 6 of John is full of it in other chapters. What does that mean, the last day? How did John imagine it? What was his world view? What was the image he had in mind? You see, these are massive questions, and there's no way of you finding the answers to them, or me finding the answers to them, without going back to the first century and rummaging around as best we can in that Hellenistic world and seeing what people meant by these words. And yet a fundamentalist will come along and knock on your door and tell you they know the answer without doing any of the study. Don't you find that extraordinary? And when you do the study, you do, as in all your fields of expertise that you've gone into, including motherhood, all these expertise, it's a big journey. And actually, isn't it true that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know? I mean, that's a common saying, but it's clearly true, because you're wise enough to know the limits of your knowledge, and that's great. Well, what did he mean? What is Matthew referring to when the disciples asked Jesus about his coming and the end of the age? End of the age. So they imagined the age going on, and we've still got that idea of goodness. Oh, God help us, don't say we. You know, these people who, year 2000, Jesus was going to appear, obviously, in America. I mean, where else would he go except to the best country in the world? So he's going to come through under. Well, why wouldn't it be the, what's the bridge there at on the west coast? The Golden Gate. I mean, for God's sake, if he didn't appear there, imagine him coming through the Golden Horn. Or something like that, in where the Muslims and the Turks are. Oh no, it could be Sydney Harbour, I suppose. But yeah, there was. So if you're expecting him to come through there, good luck to you. But I wouldn't spend, you know, take a picnic lunch, whatever you do. So, and all I'm saying really is the notion of time doesn't work. So we've got to get out of that and realise it's mythical thinking, mythical imagery. Note three, question. Is the catechism correct? You don't have to all answer it together. In interpreting the Genesis narrative as meaning that, quote, even though our nature is mortal, God destined us human beings not to die. Even though our nature is mortal, God destined us human beings not to die. That's what the Catechism says. I'm asking you to think about it, and I'm thinking about it myself. Is that correct? If they mean by death, and this is the problem with the New Testament as well, death has, it's used analogically at different levels of meaning. If you mean by death separation from God, the source of life, well, yes. And that's what Jesus says. He says, if you eat my body and drink my blood, you'll never die. Doesn't he? Often. And Paul, you've got to watch the word death all the way through. Primarily the word death, and that's very wise, of course, in the New Testament, primarily death means separation from the source of life. Sometimes death means, as in common parlance, what happens when you take your last breath and you physically leave this world, or whatever way you're going to put it, physical death. So you've got to be careful how you read it. When Jesus said, if you eat my body and drink my blood, you'll never die, he didn't mean that you won't die in the second sense. You know, he means you'll never lose your communion with God. You'll live beyond physical death. So watch the word. But if physical death, if that, even though our nature is mortal, God destined us human beings not to die, like Adam and Eve, and that's how I learnt it. I learnt that if Adam and Eve hadn't have sinned, they wouldn't have died. Meaning they'd still be here. God help us. Though, you know, they'd still be here. You know, I mean, we all love each other, but there's a time when you need to let go, really. So if it means that, they never touched the fruit of the... But in the story in the book of Genesis certainly doesn't say that. The book of Genesis is so clear. There are two trees. One's the knowledge of good and evil, which they grab and eat, don't they? The other tree is the tree of life. Now, go back to your Greeks and everybody. If you can get the fruit from the tree of life, then you will never die. Get it? That's the more. Okay, but they never get near that one. They never even touch it, never think of touching it. In fact, so that they won't touch it, as the story goes, God puts an angel there, a cherub there, with a sword, a flaming sword, lightning, clearly, to keep them out. So we don't know where paradise is. And if you see lightning, whew, it means you're getting too close to it, so you back off. Because that's the angel keeping you out of paradise, which is clearly in your backyard, but I don't know about that yet. Okay, so do you get it? They never touched that, so they were the book of Genesis never, ever imagined that we were ever immortal in the sense that physically dying. But somehow or other, as we've read that, we've taken it into our little world, and I'm not even sure the Catechism hasn't taken it in. Because on the whole, and this is one of the big criticisms of the Catechism, one of the few big criticisms, and it's everywhere, every scholar that I know of, it does seem to be taking the stories of the book of Genesis almost as events. In fact, it calls it that, as a factual statement, rather than awareness of the mythical nature of the literary form being used, which is quite extraordinary and quite bad, really, in view of what we know. A beautiful statement here about resurrection of the body now. Ignatius of Antioch, very ancient document, writing to the Romans. We're talking about the first years of the second century now, 105, 104 AD. And he's going to Rome and he knows that they're going to... He doesn't want them to try and stop him being a martyr. I'll read it for you. Leave me to be a meal for the beasts. It is they who can provide my way to God. So what do you call that big thing there? The Colosseum exists by now. It didn't exist in the 64, but it's now there, and they've got animals, and for fun, Christians were being, all that, you know, the story. I am his wheat ground fine by the lion's teeth to be made purest bread for Christ. So intercede with me for them, with him for me, that by their instrumentality I may be made a sacrifice to God. He who died for us is all that I seek. He who rose again for us is my whole desire. Here is one, speaking of himself, who longs only to be God's. Don't delude him with the things of earth. Suffer me to attain to light, pure and undefiled, for only when I am come thither shall I truly be a man. Leave me to imitate the passion of my God. If any of you has God within himself, understand my longings and feel for me, because you will know the forces by which I am constrained. Do not have Jesus Christ on your lips and the world in your heart. Here am I yearning for death with all the passion of a lover. Earthly longings have been crucified. In me there's left no spark of desire for mundane things, but only a murmur of living water that whispers within me, come, come to the Father. There's no pleasure for me in anything that perishes or in the delights of this life. My heart longs for the bread of God, the flesh of Jesus Christ, and for my drink I crave that blood of his which is undying love.